Well, I think we could all agree that today is a very special day for a number of reasons. To begin with, it's a very special day because it's the Lord's Day, and because there are Christians from literally all over the country gathered here this morning to worship God and to study from His Word, and so certainly that makes it a special day. And of course, it's also a very special day for me because it's an extreme privilege and honor for me to be asked to be a part of this lectureship. And I'm extremely grateful for this opportunity, but I also feel acutely the responsibility that this opportunity carries with it. Of course, it's also a special day because today we begin a concentrated study of a specific portion of God's Word, the second book of Corinthians. Before beginning a serious study of any passage of Scripture, whether we're talking about a verse or a chapter or an entire book, it's always helpful, and many times it's essential, to know something of the context of that passage. And so as we introduce this study of Paul's second epistle to the Corinthian church, it's important, I think, that we notice a number of historical and social and doctrinal factors which had a definite bearing on the book. The city of Corinth was undoubtedly influenced greatly by its geographical position in the ancient world. It had a very strategic position. It was located just south of the Isthmus of Corinth, and as a result, the city had very powerful influence over both the land traffic across the Isthmus from Macedonia down into Achaia, and also the sea traffic across it from the Ionian Sea overland across to the Aegean Sea. Of course, Corinth was originally a Greek city. It was destroyed by Rome in 146 BC, but then Corinth was rebuilt as a Roman colony just about 100 years later by Julius Caesar in about 46 to 44 BC. In 27 BC, Corinth became the seat of the Roman government in Achaia. And at the time of Paul's work there, it was a senatorial province and had a developing judicial system. So Corinth was an important city. It was a major center of banking, manufacture, mining, and craftsmanship. Corinth was famous for such things as its wealth, its culture, and its art and its architecture, but it was also infamous for its flagrant immorality. For example, it was just considered sort of stock humor in ancient Greek drama to portray a Corinthian as a drunkard or a prostitute or something similar. Furthermore, prostitution in the city in Paul's day was not only tolerated, but it was viewed as a great benefit to the economy. It brought in much commerce, just as it does in many major cities today. In a lot of ways, things haven't changed that much since the first century. But this pagan, immoral atmosphere must have had a profound effect on the new converts at Corinth, and this is evidenced by some of the problems which Paul had to address in the First Corinthian letter, such problems as incest among Christians, false doctrines relating to marriage and divorce, and questions concerning meats offered to idols. And for a more detailed discussion on the city and the church of Corinth, I would refer you to Brother Bert Thompson's introduction in the studies in 1 Corinthians. Well, what about who wrote the book? Some of the background behind it. We've already mentioned Paul as the author of this book, and I think it's safe to say that the authorship of 2 Corinthians is one of the most reliable pieces of information that we have concerning any New Testament book. There's widespread agreement among reputable scholars that the Apostle Paul was, in fact, the author. And unlike that of some of Paul's other books, the authenticity of this letter has rarely been questioned, even by radical skeptics. As Philip Hughes has noted in his commentary on 2 Corinthians, the evidence, both external and internal, for the Pauline authorship of this letter is so strong as to be irrefragable. Indeed, of all the epistles in the New Testament, none is, in style and temperament, more characteristic of the great apostle. In no other letter do we find so much autobiographical information, and none is more tantalizing by reason of unexplained references to persons, situations, and events with which the writer and his readers were obviously so familiar that precise definition was unnecessary. 2 Corinthians has been recognized as a genuine epistle of Paul by many uninspired writers, yet writers whom we have no reason to doubt, dating back as far as the beginning of the second century. It's even quoted by such men as Polycarp, who lived in about 105 A.D., and Irenaeus, who lived in about 185 A.D. Within the letter itself, Paul identified himself twice as the author, chapter 1 and verse 1, and chapter 10 and verse 1. And we might also note that it is highly unlikely that an impostor would portray Paul as an apostle whose authority was under fire at Corinth, or as an apostle fighting to keep the Corinthian church from apostatizing. From Acts chapter 18, we learn that Paul spent approximately 18 months in Corinth during his second missionary journey, and it was during this time, in about AD 50 to 52, that the church was established there. After leaving Corinth, Paul centered his activity around Ephesus for about the next 3 years, Acts chapter 20 and verse 31. And sometime during this period, perhaps about AD 52 to 55, Paul wrote to the Corinthians concerning fornicators in the church. We have a reference to that in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 9. This is usually referred to as the former letter because it precedes our 1 Corinthians. And apparently it has not survived to this day. But the writing of 1 Corinthians would also have to be placed somewhere in this time period. So in approximately AD 55, Paul received word from the household of Chloe of a number of serious problems in the Corinthian church. And we could reasonably infer that at about this same time, Paul also received a letter, or at the very least a message, from the brethren in Corinth, which contained several questions. And the letter, which we know as 1 Corinthians, was written both to correct these problems and to answer these questions. It was evidently sent to Corinth by the same messengers who brought the questions to Paul. That would be Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus, 1 Corinthians 16, verses 15 through 18. And Titus also accompanied this group as Paul's messenger, 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2, and 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 6. Well, if we examine the 1 Corinthian letter very carefully at all, we can see that there were a number of serious problems addressed. And we can also see that Paul didn't mince any words in dealing with them. Well, because of this, Paul was understandably anxious about the way in which this letter would be received by the brethren there. So he had arranged for Titus to meet him in Troas with a report on the Corinthian church. In Acts chapter 19, we read of the riot in Ephesus, which caused Paul to depart probably earlier than he had intended for Macedonia. But he came first to Troas, hoping to find Titus there. For some reason, however, Titus didn't arrive when Paul was expecting him. Paul was so eager to learn of the current situation in Corinth that he couldn't wait for Titus to arrive, even though he said there was an open door for evangelism in Troas, 2 Corinthians 2, verses 12 through 13. I think that's a significant point. I think it demonstrates that sometimes it's just as important to worry about those who are already Christians as it is to be concerned about teaching the gospel to alien sinners. This was evidently Paul's thinking at this point. So he left Troas, still very anxious in spirit, traveled on into Macedonia, where he met Titus and received the news from Corinth. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 6 through 7. Now, what about when the book was written and from where? The time of the beginning of the Corinthian church is generally regarded as among the best attested chronological data in the history of early Christianity. Of course, Paul planted the seed of the gospel in Corinth, from which the church grew. We learn that from Acts chapter 18. And in that account, his activities are clearly connected with the proconsulship of a man named Gallio. Well, interestingly enough, an inscription has been discovered at Delphi, dated in early AD 52, which mentions Gallio as the proconsul of Achaia. And since the account in Acts chapter 18, verses 8 through 12, suggests that the church was established there before Gallio took office, then we can be fairly confident about dating the beginning of the Corinthian church in AD 50 to 51. It's considerably more difficult, however, to be certain about how much time elapsed between the beginning of the Corinthian church and the writing of the two letters that we have to that church. In general, reputable commentators date the writing of 1 Corinthians somewhere in the period from AD 54 to 57. And this is based on the assumption that Paul left Corinth after founding the church there in AD 52 or 53. And it's based on the fact that he next spent from 2 to 3 years working in Ephesus, Acts chapter 19 and verse 10, chapter 20 and verse 31. So if we allow time for certain necessary events between the two epistles, such as the delivery of the first letter, the riot in Ephesus, Paul's journey into Macedonia, or into Troas, and then into Macedonia in search of Titus, then 2 Corinthians would be dated somewhere in the time period from AD 55 to 57. A specific date, however, is rather difficult to be conclusive about. As far as where Paul was when he wrote 2 Corinthians, A number of references within the epistle itself suggest that he was in Macedonia. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 5, chapter 8 and verse 1, chapter 9 verses 2 through 4 all mention Macedonia. And this location seems reasonable since it was here that Paul found Titus and received the report on the present condition of the church in Corinth. Furthermore, in 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 2, Paul uses the present tense in referring to the Macedonians. He says, "I am glorying on your behalf to them of Macedonia." And this suggests that he was in Macedonia as he wrote. But again, as was the case with the date, we simply don't have enough evidence to be more specific or more conclusive about where Paul was when he wrote this epistle. Well, let's look at what prompted Paul to write this letter. What was his purpose? I think we can say that the report which Titus brought from Corinth regarding the reception of the 1 Corinthian letter was, in general, a good report. It was one which brought Paul much comfort. The majority of the brethren there had responded to his letter with godly sorrow, which led them to repentance, 2 Corinthians 7, verses 8 through 10. They had made a sincere effort to obey Paul's instructions and to set everything in order, particularly with regard to the discipline of the incestuous brethren. There was, however, still a defiant and impenitent minority in the church at Corinth. This group was apparently incited by some Judaizing teachers who had come from Jerusalem. Paul referred to them as false apostles in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 13. This group maligned Paul and sought to undermine his influence and authority in every possible way that they could. They doubted his credibility to begin with because he had no letters of commendation such as they had. They said that Paul was fickle and undependable because he had changed his plans about when he would come to Corinth next, 2 Corinthians 1 verses 12 through 18. They said that though his letters were strong, his presence was weak, 2 Corinthians 10 verses 1 and 10. They said that he lacked love and perhaps even confidence in his own work because he refused financial support, 2 Corinthians 11 beginning in verse 7. In addition, they implied that he was dishonest, specifically with regard to the collection for the poor saints in Judea, 2 Corinthians 8, verses 20 to 21. And they attacked his apostleship, 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 12. In chapter 11 and verse 22, we learn that these false teachers were Jews and that they took great pride in being Hebrews of the seed of Abraham. When we look in general at the contents of 2 Corinthians, it seems apparent that Paul's purpose in writing it was threefold. To begin with, the majority of the brethren at Corinth needed to be commended and encouraged for their willing obedience to Paul's instructions. So in about the first seven chapters of the letter, Paul recounted some of his experiences with the Corinthians. He expressed his gratitude for the faithful majority. And he also expressed his renewed confidence in them, Titus's renewed confidence in them. He said, "Great is my boldness of speech toward you. Great is my glorying on your behalf." He said that he was now filled with comfort concerning them, chapter 7, verses 4 through 7. But in the second place, all of the Corinthian Christians, whether faithful or not, needed to be reminded of their pledge to contribute to Paul's collection for the poor saints in Judea. Paul had been organizing this collection for some time now. He made mention of it in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. But apparently the church at Corinth had still not fulfilled its commitment in this matter. So in chapters 8 and 9 of 2 Corinthians, Paul told how he had now begun this collection and of the great generosity of the Macedonian brethren, chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. And he also urged the Corinthians not to delay any longer in doing their part, particularly since he had already been boasting of them to the Macedonian brethren. And he even promised to send Titus to them again to ensure that the collection was completed on time. But then in the third place, as we've already noted, the news which Paul received from Titus concerning the reception of the first letter was not entirely good. There was still a rebellious and dangerous group within the church at Corinth. So in the closing portion of 2 Corinthians, Paul addressed this problem. 2 Corinthians chapters 10 through 13 contain his answers to the attacks that we've already noted that the minority group had made against him. The situation was so serious that it required Paul to list and discuss his apostolic credentials in detail. It seems clear both from the content of this section and from what we know about Paul and his character that if given a choice, Paul would not have written in this way. As Brother Rex Turner has well noted, The very thought of making a personal defense of himself was galling and out of character with Paul's sensitive nature and humility. But the opposition parties had laid numerous and damaging charges against his character. If he had failed to clear himself of the detestable innuendos and flagrant charges, his influence and work for the cause of Christ would have been hampered. Well, let's look now at some of the questions which have been raised regarding this epistle, some of the criticisms that have been leveled against it. It's long been recognized that 2 Corinthians contains a number of literary transitions which on the surface might seem rather abrupt or even illogical. Now, because of this, many critics have decided that 2 Corinthians is not a single epistle, but rather that it's a patchwork of pieces of a number of Paul's epistles, which over a period of time have been collected and pasted together by some later unknown editor. This theory, however, is extremely suspect by its very nature. Think about what it implies. To begin with, it necessitates the idea that at a very early date, a number of Paul's letters to the Corinthians had quite literally fallen to pieces through abuse or neglect or both, and that some quote-unquote editor just happened upon these pieces and assembled the work which we know as 2 Corinthians. And I hope that this sounds pretty far-fetched. But given this scenario, it would be perfectly reasonable to expect at least some corroborative evidence among the earliest copies of Paul's letters, 2 Corinthians in particular. In other words, if 2 Corinthians is composed of parts of several longer letters, then there ought to be some copies of these longer letters somewhere, or perhaps some incomplete copies of 2 Corinthians. This type of evidence, however, is simply non-existent. One commentator has pointed out that 2 Corinthians has come down to us as a single epistle. In no manuscript is there any trace of a division at any point in the letter or any variation in the arrangement of the material. And in no early Christian writer is there any suggestion that the document is composed of parts of different letters or that it was not all written at one time to meet one particular situation. But in order to further demonstrate the doubtfulness of this hypothesis, we simply have to look carefully at the passages which are most often criticized, which are most often called into question. To begin with, it's argued that 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14 through chapter 7, verse 1 must be viewed as an extraneous insertion. In other words, a passage which doesn't belong there. Just before this section, Paul had been making a very personal and intimate appeal to the Corinthians, entreating them to respond to him as he had to them. Chapter 6, verses 11 through 13. In chapter 6, 14 through chapter 7 and verse 1, Paul seems to admonish them somewhat sternly regarding their relationship to unbelievers. And because these verses seem to interrupt the thought of the context, and because they appear to be similar in theme to Paul's former letter that we mentioned, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 9, many critics have argued that this passage must be a part of that former letter. And critics are also quick to point out that if chapter 6 through 6:14 through verse chapter 7 and verse 1 is simply omitted from the text, it still flows smoothly. In other words, you can read directly from chapter 6 and verse 13 to chapter 7 and verse 2, and it doesn't appear that there's anything missing. But there are other explanations for this phenomenon, which are just as plausible, if not more so. In the first place, any serious student of the Bible has to admit that sudden digressions were not at all uncommon in the writings of Paul. They occur in many passages, the unity of which has never been in question. In addition, when we consider Paul's familiarity with preaching and teaching among the heathen, would it be so unnatural for him to use similar language when addressing his own brethren? Particularly if the unbelievers that he mentions in 2 Corinthians 6:14 refer to his opponents at Corinth. Furthermore, the apparent connection that the critics see between chapter 6 and verse 13 and chapter 7 and verse 2 may simply be an indication that Paul realized that he had digressed somewhat, and now he was returning to his main theme again. So it's not nearly as cut and dried as the critics would have us believe. Of course, one of the most popular theories concerning the unity of 2 Corinthians is that chapters 10 through 13 are part of another letter, which is now lost. Many people just can't imagine that Paul could have written both the first 9 chapters and the last 4 chapters of this book to the same group of people in the same setting. They point out that in the first part of 2 Corinthians, Paul's words were very positive and encouraging, and that his tone was confident. In the last section of the book, however, there is a notable, and some would argue, a drastic change in mood and in style. Here it seems that Paul was preoccupied with his reputation among the Corinthian Christians, and that he went to great lengths to defend himself, and he warns of the possible consequences of his next visit to Corinth. Compare 2 Corinthians 10, verse 8, and chapter 12, and verse 21, and chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. And if the first nine chapters are characterized by joy and comfort and relief, it is argued, then the final four chapters are characterized by doubt and anxiety and indignation. Now, because of this sudden shift, many contend that chapters 10 through 13 must be a part of what they call a painful or a sorrowful letter, which Paul wrote out of much affliction and anguish of heart and with many tears, a letter which Paul mentions, in fact, in 2 Corinthians 2, verses 4 through 9. Well, it's already been noted, however, that there's no evidence to support the idea that any such painful letter ever existed, much less that it has been tacked on to the end of 2 Corinthians. And furthermore, I personally don't have any difficulty in imagining that Paul was referring to 1 Corinthians as the letter which he wrote out of much affliction and anguish of heart. Surely it must have cost Paul many tears to have to address the numerous and serious problems which we find addressed in that epistle. While there's clearly a change in tone beginning with the 10th chapter, this is hardly sufficient ground for concluding that the last four chapters are part of another book. So we've already mentioned this phenomenon of a sudden change in tone is found in many ancient writings, both inspired and uninspired, and it may be accounted for simply by the circumstances under which the epistle was written. A much more reasonable explanation for this shift, if not a more obvious explanation based on the context, is that in chapters 1 through 9 of 2 Corinthians, Paul was primarily addressing the faithful majority of the church, that is, those who had responded properly to the 1 Corinthian letter, while chapters 10 through 13 were written for the benefit of the impenitent minority, those who were still working to undermine Paul's influence and authority. And furthermore, it's quite possible that some time may have elapsed between the writing of the first nine chapters and the last four chapters. Time enough, perhaps, for Paul to have received additional information which he felt needed to be addressed. Well, as we begin this study of 2 Corinthians, we need to realize that it's one of the most unusual and most valuable books of the New Testament. It's unusual because it doesn't seem to follow any definite plan or arrangement, such as Paul's epistle to the Romans or his first epistle to the Corinthians, for example. Rather, Paul seems to have addressed each subject as it occurred to him. 2 Corinthians has been referred to as the least systematic, the most personal, the most emotional, the most defensive, and the most difficult to follow of all of Paul's writings. The great value and the great importance of 2 Corinthians lie in the wealth of autobiographical information which it contains. There are so many interesting and exemplary and, in a sense, inspiring details in the life of the Apostle Paul which are contained in this letter. Details about his travels, his sacrifices, his persecutions, and his personality. And these details would be completely lost to history if they were not recorded in this book. But perhaps equally important is the insight which this book, along with 1 Corinthians, provides concerning the life of the early church. So a study of 2 Corinthians is an extremely profitable enterprise for the individual Christian and for the entire church as a whole. May God bless our study of it this week. Thank you for your attention.